what C++ is and what it's supposed to be and how we are getting there. And then I'm going to go through some practical details. I'm very interested in resource management, mostly because I'm into systems programming and building complex systems where resources has to be dealt with, dealing with object-oriented programming, class hierarchies, which I assume most of you have seen. Then I'm going to get into a bit of template programming, generic programming with templates, and then I'm going to point out that, you know, this is a real-world language with real-world problems. We can do better still. I listen in to discussions in real life and on the web, and it seems that often I'm the only one around who doesn't have a firm opinion about what C++ is. Here we see the blind men and the elephant, and if all you've seen is sort of the tail, you have some firm idea of what the elephant is like, except it's only right for the tail. So everything we see here is probably true for somebody at some time in some place. And if you think that's the whole story, you're wrong. And so my problem is I actually know the beast, and it's a little bit harder to generalize what the beast is when you have to take it all into account. So I'm trying to explain a little bit about the beast here, about that elephant. So let's go back and see what I would like. What I'd like when I started C++, what I have learned over the years that I want. Type safety is a really important aspect. And when I started out, a C program couldn't check the types of its function arguments. There was no function prototypes, there was no function declarations that specified the types. And this was actually fairly controversial at the time. People said, well, you know, If you have a declaration of type, then when I look at my call, I do not know what it's doing because it depends on something I can't see. I'd much rather have it just like an assembly code. I just do something and I don't have to look anywhere else. Okay, so I have actually been trying to increase the type safety of the C++ family of languages since day one. And that's not all that easy because it's under constraints of size of programs, performance of programs, and such. Resource safety, I really don't want to leak things. If you are writing code for say, a spaceship, you should not run out of resources. The resources can be just about anything, but I think about things like memory, file handles, communication connections, locks, things like that. Performance, my business by and large, self-chosen, is to be able to, among other things, run as fast as possible close to the hardware. Some language has to be able to implement a memory manager and a virtual machine and things like that. And C++, more or less by definition, is that. That's the aim. Predictability. If you get into hard real-time, you really have to have every operation be executed in a predictable time, usually a low constant maximum time. And operations that can't do that are just simply not allowed on planes after they take off. I'm not talking about the entertainment system, of course. I'm talking about the engine controls and the things that deals with the flipping of the wings. And C++ follows that rule roughly, except for the use of free store, dynamic memory, which is not allowed there anyway, and you have to do something else. Teachability, it really should be possible to teach how to do this kind of stuff, how to use something. You can't just assume people will want to learn something. You have to make it reasonably easy, and the complexity of the code should be proportional to the complexity of the task you're doing. That is a very big statement, very hard to do. It's an ideal. It's something you can try and approach. And in different domains, you can get closer than others. But it's definitely what I would like to see. And I would like to have the code be readable by humans and machines. Again, those of you who know C++ knows that this is just an ideal because you can write really ugly code in C++. As a matter of fact, you can write really ugly code in any language, but this is C++ I'm concerned about. It should be possible to write really nice readable code, and you can. And I want it for systems programming, embedded systems, resource-constrained systems, and for large systems. That's the sort of the domain I'm most interested in. It is not optimized for writing simple web apps, for instance. It's not. It's not meant to be the simplest programming language on Earth. It's supposed to be the simplest we can get for real-world constrained applications. C++ is expert-friendly. It's very expert-friendly. I coined the phrase to point out that that's not enough. If it's only expert-friendly and it's hostile to new users, to novices, to casual users, we're not helping a lot of people that could be helped. So it has to be novice-friendly, too. That's an important thing. And I'll show you some code that makes this statement plausible. C++ comes from two traditions in programming languages, and quite consciously so. Here is this line here, which is deliberately towards the low end. This is sort of close to optimal exploitation of the hardware. The ability to manipulate anything you have in hardware and do it well. So we started with assembler. We got languages by BC, PL, and C. C is still around. This is Dennis Ritchie, and his genius was actually to define a model of hardware that was sort of general and could be used. I mean, if you add something, you use the add instruction. If you access memory, memory are sequences of objects. When you want to compose something out of other objects, you just put them next to each other. You stack things of the same type next to each other and you get arrays. You stack things of different types on another and you get structs. That's a very nice memory model. It has stood the test of time very well. However, this is low-level stuff. I don't really like programming with bits and bytes and addresses and things like that. We need something that is more fit for humans. And here we have Backus, who invented Fortran. Fortran was a language designed for a very particular kind of humans, engineers and scientists. And it was the first language to lift the level of programming from being focused on the machine to being focused on the problem. It was the first language that really was fit for humans. And once that was done, we actually got portability. I mean, Fortran was designed so that IBM could sell more machines. And it turned out that after Fortran, you could take these programs and with fairly minor changes, move them to, say, a UNIVAC, which was a main competitor at the time. And that was, I believe, an unintentional effect, but it was very good for us. And lifting things up to a human level is a good idea. However, as I pointed out, scientists and engineers are very peculiar subspecies. And once they had it, their own language, everybody else wanted one too, COBOL being the most prominent for business. But basically, very soon we had about a couple of hundred languages. And the problem was they couldn't talk to each other. I mean, when you write something in COBOL, you can do really nice record and file manipulation. That was what it was for. That was what the business people wanted. It could add and subtract, but anything more sophisticated than that, it was not very good at. Fortran was really good at linear algebra for computations, could handle floating point numbers. Now, what do I do if I, as a scientist, wants to read some records, manipulate them, and compute on the result? The answer roughly was you're out of luck. And there was many, many solutions to this, but the breakthrough, I think, was this. This is Christian Nygaard with the language Simula. He said, why don't you let people build their own abstractions? Instead of building in matrices and records and things like that, why don't you just say, give people the language facilities for building their own abstractions into the language. So if you want a vector, you build a vector. If you want a 3D matrix, you build a 3D matrix. And if you have a record, you build a record. That's where the class concept came in. And they used hierarchies of classes to represent related concepts. Some concepts are hierarchically oriented, not all. And basically, you got what's currently known as object-oriented programming languages with classes and class hierarchies. And I found myself in a project a long time ago at Bell Labs where I needed to manipulate the lower levels of the hardware, write memory managers, write network drivers, but I also needed to construct something that had a fairly high complexity of organization. I wanted to be able to say, this bit here runs there, this bit there runs there. No, I changed my mind. This bit here should move over there. It was a distributed system. Languages at the time that could do the hard, close to the hardware programming, could not say what a bit was. It was sort of a ball of code. There was no serious abstraction there. And so I took the similar class concept and built it into C, and some of the terminology comes from Simula and has later been inherited by lots of other languages. And this happened in 1980, and we've been going on for a while since. We have a new standard there in 11. We're going to get a new one this year. It's all the technical work's being done. It's going through voting procedures under the ISO. So if you want to explain what C++ is, it's from this idea of taking this C and taking Simula and putting them together. So we want a direct map from to hardware between the instructions and data types in C++, coming initially from C, and we want zero overhead abstraction, the ability to take these things, wrap them into new types with data representation and set of operations or interfaces defined and then being implemented later, initially from Simula. One of the really key things that came in very, very early in the C++ development, very early being like the third week or thereabouts, constructors and destructors, because if you want to build your own abstractions and you want objects of them, very often the object needs to be initialized, and if it holds something that needs to be cleaned up, you need to call a destructor to do it. And so a lot of it came in here as the advance in understanding and the number of kind of abstractions we're dealing with could be done. And basically much of the inspiration at the time came from operating systems. My background is in operating systems and microprogramming, machine architecture, and such. That explains a lot for good and bad. And basically, I've been wondering this question: what does C++ want to be? When it grows up? And the answer is, wants to be better at that. That is C++'s domain. If you are in a different domain, you will probably want different languages. And one thing that people point out is that there's a lot of old crud in C++. It's like a ship that's been at sea for a long time. It has acquired barnacles and such. And we would all like to get rid of them, but we can't. Because long-term stability, compatibility is a feature. People say, we want all of these new great things, but we do not want you to break our code. This problem will probably be addressed in the future through code analysis and code transformation. I hope we'll see more of that. But basically, remember this one. If you want C++ to be different and better, the next question is, can I break your code? And I think I know the answer. At least for people with large code bases, that's important as opposed to a hobbyist. And so here's my version of the elephant. It's a language designed for building basically efficient and elegant abstractions four areas like software infrastructure, resource constraint, applications. Okay, so this is one of these pictures that are there to get me to stop, take a deep breath, think. Now comes a new topic, which is resource management. How do we deal with resources? Basically, a resource is something that you have to acquire, and then when you're finished with it, you have to give it back to wherever you got it from. And this can be explicit, it can be implicit, but that's the definition of a resource. The example is memory. Give me some memory. I have to give it back, otherwise we have a memory leak. It's a file handle. Give me, open the file, close the file, get a lock, acquire the lock, release the lock, open a socket connection, close the socket connections, things like that. And we don't want leaks. We really don't want the space probe to run out of anything. We don't want our cell phones to crash once a day because it runs out of anything but electricity. We can't actually handle battery life like this, except, of course, if we run more efficiently, we'll use less battery. But that's a different issue. And usually, a resource should have an owner, because otherwise it's really hard to know who's responsible for giving back resources. The fact that there's no obvious representation of an owner in a language like C or C-style, C++, is why these programs tend to leak. Say I make myself a shape that's up on the screen, and I get a pointer to that shape. Who is responsible for getting the shape off the screen again? Is it the screen manager or is it me? Okay. Then I give the pointer to the shape to him. Is it now his job or is it mine? That is a source of a lot of problems in C-style programming. We need to deal with that. So basically, the rule is there should be an owner. That's often a handle like this that points to the real resource, the real object. And basically, the handle should represent something meaningful. It could be a vector, it could be a pointer to something, could be just about anything. Okay, so in the C++ standard, there's actually a lot of things that behaves like that. You see all the sort of the main data structures, vectors, strings, maps, hash tables, and such, all follow this model. And so whenever you have one of these, it's a local object, and it points to something that it manages over on the side. And when it goes away, goes out of scope, it cleans up its mess after it. And it's not just memory, threads, logs, file streams, and shared pointers are in this category. So this is all over the current C++ standard. And basically, they all sort of more or less look like this. Here is an abstraction, which is a vector of T's. And so you can initialize it in some way. All the interesting classes have some way of initializing them. In this place of case, you can give it an initializer list of T's. An initializer list of T's is sort of a list of things in curly braces. So here I'm saying that if you want to make a vector, you have to give me an initializer list. It will then make a list, and it'll actually represent it some way. It'll set aside some memory. It'll put the elements of the list into that vector, into that memory. It keeps track of how many things it's got, how many elements it's got. That's about the simplest you can do. And now you can make a vector of doubles and initialize it, a vector of strings and initialize it. And the important thing here is that when they go out of scope, the whole thing gets cleared up. Notice this is not the simplest of memory managements, at least vector of strings. Strings are themselves handled. So to clean up that vector of strings, I have to tell the vector to clean itself up, and the vector has to tell all its strings to clean themselves up. And we could do more complicated things like that, having a vector of records with locks associated with them, things like that. But anyway, it's a very simple model. You can create things, and you clean up your mess when you're finished. The cleanup is implicit. And so here is a sort of classical example. You find it all over million line code bases, and it's a mess. Let's see what's wrong here. I want a gadget, and say I'm a Java programmer or a C++ programmer that still thinks it's cool to write code like in the 90s. I make myself a gadget, and I assign that to a pointer, the pointer I get back. And there's a lot of code like that. The point here is I won't tell you what's in the gadget, but there could be all kinds of interesting things. Think it has a file handle, for instance. It opens a file or something. So here I do some code that might throw an exception, I do something that might return, and then I delete things. And all good Java programmers will complain that they has to write the delete that's such a pain in the neck. And we know that if you actually have to write such code, you'll get it wrong a fair amount of time. As a matter of fact, my rule these days is if I see a new, I know I have to write a delete somewhere, therefore I'll get it wrong, therefore I shouldn't write the new. But let's see. A garbage collector could be an idea. It's just take away this one and everything will work, except that we don't know what's inside the gadget. It may hold things that needs to be cleaned up, so we won't do that. So then the naked pointer is a problem also. If I throw an exception, I have leaked the gadget. If I return, I have leaked the gadget. This is actually not good code. So we can do something like this. This is fairly modern C++. It's been used heavily for the last sort of 15, 20 years in places. We have a shared pointer. I'm here using a C++ 13 notation for it. It says, make me a gadget and return a shared pointer to me. A shared pointer is sort of a simple implementation of garbage collection. The first garbage collectors were counter pointer things, and several languages call it garbage collection to this day. The point here being that if I throw an exception, the destructor for that shared pointer there fires and cleans up the mess. Similarly, if I return, the mess is cleaned up, my code gets simpler, there's no delete down there, whenever we get out, it gets cleaned up. Fine, constructors and destructors handle this problem. There's only one problem left is, I'm not sharing anything. That gadget is mine, all mine. So why do I need to do things like a use count to count the number of users of the gadget? I know the number of users, it's me, one. So we can simplify that if you want. We can make a unique pointer to a gadget and everything works simple. It's simple and cheap. One of the problems with shared pointers is that they have to maintain a use count. A use count is a shared resource. It's shared between all users of the pointer. And so when you make more pointers to that shared object, the use count goes up, 1, 2, 3, 2, 2. When it gets to 0, the last guy out cleans up. It still cleans up everything, and we don't have any leaks of file handles and such. But it still, if there's nothing shared, I shouldn't introduce a shared resource. We are in a world where lots of forms of concurrency happens, and anything shared costs more than you imagine it does. So this is better. But you know, I own that gadget. Why am I dealing with pointers? I should have just done it simply in the first place. There are no need for any pointers here. I just make my gadget, and the destructor for gadget gets thrown. If we get out of here, we can get out here, we can get out here, we can get out here. Doesn't matter. Destructor is called, cleaned up so the exceptions, and that is good. And basically, we've reached the point where the code looks simpler, and there are no pointers. There are some behind the scene, but it's easy to write a constructor and a destructor pair that takes care of resources. So this is good. And this is known by the amazing phrase, resource acquisition is initialization, which I consider the proof that I shouldn't be in marketing. And basically, it just does what we said. And it happens to be a good way of dealing with a system that uses exceptions, and exceptions is the best way of dealing with error handling, because it will give the right thing, things had to happen, especially when you have destructors to help you clean out local resources. And so we can write leak-free code, and in general what you do is you establish an invariant in the constructor and tear it down if necessary in the destructor. Fine. And if you don't need a destructor, well, don't write one. Now, where do we then use pointers? We use them as references and iterators. So we don't use them to represent ownership. We use them to refer to objects that are owned by somebody. Every object should have an owner. And this leaves one problem. This problem has been there for a long time in the C++ community. People tend to want to return a lot of stuff from a function to its caller, like make something, like make a shape, make a matrix of 100,000 elements, some things like that. You tend to use new to put it over on the free store and then return a pointer. And the minute you do that, all the problems with pointers come back. You have to decide who is in charge of the object. Is it the creator of the pointer or is it user of the pointer? If I share the pointer, how do I know who I shared it with? You basically can't solve those problems. So let's deal with this. We've always been able to deal with it. A lot of these things are not new. A lot of these things are not original, but we have easier ways of doing them now, and that's important. It makes it easier for sort of the mythical average programmer to deal with it. So let's consider where this picture happens, the idea that you make a big thing and you need to pass it out of a function. My examples with the gadget and such all worked within a single scope. Now we're talking about communicating between scopes. So there's limits to what I can do with scopes. And this happens with factory functions, functions that make things, and functions returning lots of objects, containers, and things like that. So let's take a classical example, take an operator plus on matrices. A matrix could be big, right? So I take in two matrices, and I'm supposed to return a matrix that's the sum of the others. So make a new matrix, fill it up with the good stuff, and return it back. Now, the matrix may be 100,000 by 100,000 doubles, so even on a modern architecture, you can tell that you probably shouldn't copy it on the way back. So let's try and return a pointer. That's actually not such a bright idea. We get the pointer problems, but it also looks ugly. I want to deal with matrices, not pointers to matrices, and I don't want to go around dereferencing matrices to get the result. And apart from that, how many of you spotted the bug before I now pointed it out to you? There's a bug right there. This should not compile in any decent program, and it won't. So anyway, people say they like references better than pointers, so let's try this. We pass in references, after all, by reference. That's good. Let's try and return by reference. Now this code looks nice, except who deletes the object? Who says delete to the pointer? Well, which pointer? Where is it? I've hidden the problem. That doesn't mean that the problem went away. This is almost certain to leak even faster than the examples I've shown before. Then people have solved this by saying, okay, so an add operation for matrices, something that generates big objects, should take its arguments by reference and return its argument by reference. Now you have to set up a target and then program against it. Now we are regressing to assembly code. We just lost 300 years of experience of how to write down math and related things. I really don't like that. This works in places. A lot of this works. Just like dealing with the pointers directly, it works if you have enough time to deal with it and your programs are simple enough. But often they aren't. So we have to deal with it. And the obvious thing is that if you are making a new object, you should return a new object, right? The plus operation says, make me a vector where the elements are the sums of the elements of my arguments. So I have to return a matrix. The problem is that the semantics of returning is the semantics of copying. Sometimes compilers can figure out how to optimize that, but it's not guaranteed. So what we do here is that we return 10 million elements, and it's painful. So we try and do tricks. And these tricks, by and large, are non-general and tricky, brittle. That's not good. So what we should do is something else. And the key here is something that we all learned when we were about 6 months old. Right, here's an object here. Now it's over here. There's nothing there. It's as simple as that. Now, only a computer scientist could get the idea that to get this one over there, we make a copy of it, put it over there, and then destroy the original. It's just doesn't make sense, right? But that's what people have more or less been doing for a long time, or they built some handle to this one and moves the handle over there, leaving the original in place, or some other complicated stuff. We need to have something really simple. And the really simple looks like this. Okay, very naive. I want a matrix that is a sum of the that has elements that are the sum of the two things, and then I return it. That code should work, and we can make it work because we can simply steal the representation. I make R. It's there. It's filled with all kinds of good stuff. I want it over there. So what I do is I take this pointer, put it over there, and make this one point to nothing so that when the destructor comes and cleans up the mess, there is basically no mess to clean up. And as I mentioned, there have been compilers over the last 20 years that could do this kind of trickery by themselves because it was an optimized version, but here I'm not relying on any optimization. So we are moving the matrix by doing two word copies to copy the pointer. And if the optimizer works, we can get rid of that copy too, because, well, that can be optimized away. Anyway, so this is dirt cheap. And the way that code is done is we write what's called a move constructor. We have constructors that construct things from basically arbitrary things. We have copy constructors that define what copy means. We have move destructors that defines what move means. This notation here in the best C style is cryptic, and that means a move constructor. And so basically copy the representation, set the representation to nothing. This is it. Now this code works. And it's efficient, even if there's 10 million elements here. So that is actually very simple. And by the way, you don't have to write all of these constructors yourself. If your representation knows how to copy and move, so do you. The language will generate the constructors and destructors for you. So if I defined a matrix as a vector of doubles, that's the elements, and by the way, the vector of doubles, of course, knows how many doubles it contains, then I don't have to write any more code. Because if you move a matrix, you move its representation, which is the elements, which knows how to move, and you're finished. This code here is efficient and leak-proof, exception-proof, and dramatically simpler than some of the code we have seen over the last many years. Okay, that's it. So here's my comment about garbage collection. The garbage collection is neither general nor ideal. It is not general because it only takes care of memory, and a lot of my resources are not memory. And it's not ideal because it imposes a shared resource on the system. So some of the old Sun servers, you could get them with 64 processors, and a lot of the time, 63 of the processors sits waiting for the 64th to garbage collect. We're better today, somewhat better, but it's still fundamentally a shared resource in a distributed world where we don't actually need to impose sharing. So you may have heard of the notion of false sharing. There's an equivalent for garbage collection. So what do? Keep your data in containers, like that matrix or that vector or that map or that hash table or something like that, and manage it with RAII, the constructor, destructor stuff I showed you. Use move constructors so they are essentially free to move around. Copy constructors when you want to copy. Use smart pointers if you need pointer semantics. When do you do that? Say, take the old shape example. If I want a pointer to the interface class shape, and I can deal with pointers to circles and triangles and heaven knows what, you just use smart pointers. If you're the only owner and you just want to pass it around, you can use your unique pointer. If you are using a shared pointer, if you're sharing the object so that you don't know who's responsible for deleting it, you use a shared pointer. I mean, when would you need a shared pointer? A classical example is that you pass some data to 3 or 12 tasks that runs in parallel. Hopefully for you, you either have some locking mechanism or you have pass a pointer to const. And now the last of these threads, concurrent tasks, is supposed to clean out and delete the object pointed to, the shared object. And the shared pointers work really nicely for that. But if all you do is to see the use count go 1, 2, 1, 0, that's not the optimal way. And that's what the way they're actually mostly used in existing code. People use them to pass out information from inside functions. Then if you're still leaking, usually for old code, you can do what's called litter collection. That is, you ever so infrequently run the garbage collector, like once every day, because there's not that much garbage, so you don't have to run it all the time. And there's a standard interface to that kind of collectors, and they actually work rather well if you have a lot of old code that you can't convert to the modern style. So let me show some modern C++ code that sort of illustrates this. Here, I want to find all elements in the container C that has the value V. This is just a trivial example, of course. So what do I return? I return a vector of pointers to the elements. The value type of a container is the type of the elements. And so the way I write this function, obviously, is make myself a container to hold the things that match. And then for all x in C, if it's a match, push back its address. And I'm using a fair number of new C++ features here. There's auto that says find the type statically from the element, from its initializer. And so obviously this is the element type of the container. I pass things by reference here. I don't want to have copies. And then I return by value. And now I can write things like this. Mary had a little lamb. For all p, all pointers in there that comes back from find all, test that I actually got the right thing back. It's a little test program that just tests the sanity of this, but the point being, it may not look like the C++ you're used to. In C++ 98, there's a major performance bug right there, but fortunately you can't write it in C++ 98 because I loaded it up with a few C++ 11 features. If I'm going to use move semantics, I am definitely loading up the program with a few explicit features so that it breaks if you try and compile it with a C++ 98 compiler. I'll much rather my code breaks than to get a performance bug that you might get there. Okay, let's look at object-oriented programming. I'm going to be brief here because you all probably know it better than I do. So here's the good old shape example. Here, except that I take a vector of unique pointers to shapes. So this is a classical example of where you want a polymorphic pointer. I load the vector up with a couple of objects, which I create using make unique. It says, make me a circle and give me back a unique pointer. Okay, note the absence of news, note the absence of raw pointers that are just the representation of the address in memory. And now I said draw them all, I go for all of them and call draw. I'll get back to what a drawable sequence is later. So that's fairly simple, and it is the classical object-oriented example, except that this one here is fairly brief and it doesn't leak at all. Of course, a shape looks the way it has done for a long time, borrowed the word virtual from the similar guys that invented the mechanism, and I borrowed the word class from them. Why it isn't called type? Well, it was Simula was invented by mathematicians, and it seemed natural to them. And then the only thing that's new here is that you can be explicit about overriding. If you want to say there must be a draw with this type, it takes no argument, returns a void in the base class for me to override, so I get some checking. It's just slight little refinement that some people like. You don't have to do it if you don't like it. The protection model is public, protected, and private. Beware of protected. It will cause bugs for you if you use it for data. There are people who think it is really cool because it allows anybody to molest my data. There's usually a different explanation, but that's what it is. You open the representation to be modified later. It makes it really hard to have an invariant. So this one here is for functions only. We have multiple inheritance. So does, of course, every language that provides a static interface. It's just that they only provide interface inheritance. We have implementation inheritance too. We can discuss that if we want, but we need at least interface inheritance, inheritance of abstract classes. That class is abstract. It has no full implementation. There's a minimal runtime type identification. We have not gone into the sort of the serious reflection kind of world. Okay, so object-oriented programming inheritance is great when you have hierarchical concepts in your domain. That's why it is so nice with the shape example, because obviously a smiley face is a circle that's a shape or something like that. You can get into trouble even then, but basically it's if you have a domain where you have hierarchical relationships, it works fine. The indirect function calls, the virtual functions, are fairly cheap. I have been told by measurements recently that this figure is too high. That is, it's closer to zero overhead than before. If you call it a few times, the branch predictors have been improving dramatically, so I am actually being pessimistic here. But the main problem is it doesn't inline well. If the operation you want to pass along is something really simple, you don't get inlining, and in high performance uses, that's important. And anyway, you tend to use allocation, deallocation, et cetera, et cetera. This is pretty good, though you do get greater coupling between programs parts. You can mitigate that by having better interfaces, abstract-based classes, but basically inheritance is seriously and systematically overused and misused. There are people who think good programming means object-oriented programming, and object-oriented programming means use of enormous hierarchies. Certainly the first part of that statement is wrong. There's lots of good code that are not object-oriented, and there's lots of lousy code that are object-oriented by that definition. That said, I'll go on to the next thing, which is generic programming, which has been wildly popular and successful in the last sort of 10, 15 years. So let's look at that. I'd like to point out that the first paper I ever wrote on C with classes, C++'s predecessor, included generic programming. And I explained why I really wanted a vector of t where t was a parameter, and I really wanted operations of vector of t's that had t as a parameter. I mean, if I have a vector of t's, I want to sort a vector of t's. I don't want to fix T arbitrarily for operation. So I wanted that, and I wrote blithely that you could do that with macros. That did not scale. It's a lousy solution. In 87 or so, I decided that we needed something better. We needed something extremely general and flexible. I never trusted the science that could only do what I imagined. And I wanted zero overhead because I wanted to put C arrays out of business if I could. The C array is my least favorite data structure. It is the ideal structure for accessing memory directly. But most of the time, that's not what we want. C arrays has a tendency of losing their size. I mean, with the slightest excuse, an array turns into a pointer to one or more elements. Actually, it turns into a point. Yes, that's what it does, one or more elements. Except that other pointers can refer to zero or more elements. This is the source of a lot of problems. So basically, I wanted to compete with that because I wanted data structures that, for starters, did not convert to pointers and remembered their size. And then I wanted well-specified interfaces. I pointed out one of the very first things I did with C++, with C, when I built C++, was provide better type checking. So obviously, I wanted interface checking for this. And I looked at it, and at the time, nobody knew how to do those three. And I couldn't figure out how to do it. Given the constraints of my overall problem, I had to pick the two first. And you know, two out of three ain't bad, but it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel right. And so I've been trying to solve that ever since. And I actually do have a solution, which I'm going to show you in not too great detail. But let's first see how templates have worked up till now. You can write yourself, you can parameterize a type, then you can parameterize an algorithm with a type, and most of the time you have to be explicit about the type of a type, sorry, the parameter to a type. You don't have to be it for a use of that type, you simply deduce what T is. If that V happens to be a vector of integers, obviously the T that parameterized sort can be implicit and is, it'll be a sort of integers. If it's a vector of strings, it will be a it'll sort strings. Fine. What you can do here is anything that you you can call it compile time duck typing. Duck typing is a general principle that if it walks like a duck and it quacks, it's a duck. In other words, you just use the argument type. And if it worked, it worked. And if it didn't work, you get an error message. The only good thing about the error messages you get is you get it at compiler link time before the program gets shipped to a customer. The bad news is that these error messages can be spectacularly bad. My best example recently was I had a 7-line program that used one little parameterized class, and I was using Sigwin on a Windows machine, and I never figured out what the first few pages of the error messages was because it blew my Windows buffer, Sigwin window buffer. Then I tried another compiler, and I got the same result, except that the error messages were totally different. And it had nothing to do with the code I wrote that was in any way obvious. So we really should deal with this. So I'm trying. First of all, let's see. We need what we have found is that people write compile time programs. And they have really good reasons for it, mostly performance, but also to express things as directly as possible. Why delay to runtime what you can do at compile time, so you get your errors and things like that. So people have been doing this. And so like any new feature that's sort of cool, powerful, expressive, efficient, it gets overused. And there's been serious overuse. In particular, people write template metaprogramming to compute values. C++11 provides you the ability to write functions that's executed at compile time, which take care of some of the worst abuses of templates. I'll get to other ways of improving that in a second. But first, I'll show those of you who haven't seen all that much C++ what the code looks like. We can parameterize data types with integers, and we can parameterize algorithms with that. So I can sort the vector of integers here, and I can find the find my hometown in a list of strings. And the usual way we deal with returning a failure is to return the end. If I'm looking through a list for something and I found the end instead of what I was looking for, that's the way it is. So we can write code like this. We parameterize an element type and container type. I could also do the find in the vector of integers, so it's generic code, and that's part of the appeal of this. We can also parameterize on criterias, actions, algorithms. So here I want to have a find something that not really is equal to something, but has a property here. We write a predicate. Is it less than Griffin? And it's strings, so that's meaningful. And basically that's done by doing what's known as function object. You write a little class that can hold state so that you use in your operation. And when you can construct it, of course, everything has constructors, and there is an application operator that is invoked to call it, and it'll do something. In this case, it compares to S. And of course, there's a destructor here to clean up that string that we gave it. It has to disappear. And so you can write code like this once you have the less than. And this, people find it a bit of a nuisance to write all of that. It's all of five lines, but sometimes that's too much for people. So you can use what's called a lambda expression that basically writes the code for you. So now we can compare a string compared to Griffin. Lots of languages have these days. Okay. This is the code that you write to implement this. If you think C code is beautiful, this is beautiful. If you don't think it, well, this is what you got anyway. And it very closely models what is being done in the machine. So, and it generates very nice code, whether it is a list or a vector or a C array or something like that. So this is the way the code is done. And if you get tired of writing those sequences, where did you have a sequence? Yeah, from the beginning to the end, that's the way it's expressed. And that's the most general form, because now you can sort half a sequence or a quarter of a sequence and things like that. It composes very nicely, but it is a nuisance because the most common case is to do a whole sequence. So you can do this, sort the sequence using the predicate P, and then I simply say use the standard source from the beginning to the end using P as a predicate. So you can easily write a simpler form of code so that your code shrinks. It'll still execute at exactly the same speed. So those of you who are used to C++ will know this is straight code, so that's not a problem. But basically, we're working on the third part of the definition of templates. How do we specify the interface to a template? How do we specify the requirements that a template has on its arguments? And the way we're doing it, we're saying doctyping just isn't enough. We want to state the intent. In other words, we want to specify a template's requirements on its arguments. And basically, the programmer always knows that. I mean, you can't get working code that's templatized unless you have a good idea about what requirements there are. The actual template argument supposed to do for you? I mean, if I'm having a matrix of numbers, I want numbers. If I'm having a vector of elements, they have to have the property of an element. An element can be copied, you can take its address and things like that. The number is something you can add, multiply, or something like that. So you know it already. It's just there's been no way of saying it. So what we can say here, in a container for sort, I want my the type container cont to be sortable. And what's sortable? It's a predicate. It's a predicate you apply. It's either true or false for a given type. I apply sortable to a vector, and it'll say something like, do you have random access? Is there something you can do random access to? And do you have an element type? And can the elements of that type be compared? In this case, using less than, which is the default. So that's what the sortable does, and it will, if you look it up, be about three lines of code that says in code just what I do. And today I actually write code in C++ 11. I put a comment there, and I use this simply as my shorthand for writing good requirements. I have a set of concepts that, so I can provide the specification in a concise way. And in C++ 14, the concepts that are coming there, this will be code. So we can also have some notation here. As, if I want a sort of sortable, it means that I can write it's a sortable type S that you are sorting, which means that there has to be a type that is sortable, and I pass that. So it's just a shorthand, and you can use that for lambdas too. I can say I want a lambda that work for sortable C, so a container C. So it all works out. And now let's see how it works. I have here the template of sortable container. That's fine. It's not quite the densest notation we've got, but it's pretty much. There should be a type that's sortable, and that's the type of my container. I make myself a vector of doubles, I make myself a list of integers, I sort the vector, everything's fine. What happens here is that it says, is vector of double a container? Yeah, I can have random access, it has an element type I can compare, it's fine. Sort the list, is it a random access iterator? No, it's not. You can only search through a list. You can't access the nth element directly. So the actual error message coming out here, list of integer does not satisfy the constraint of sortable. So those of you who have suffered from the template definitions of the last 15 years, I'm sorry, I didn't know how to do that then. Now we do. There is an implementation of this stuff. It's a branch of GCC. Look up concepts, Andrew Sutton, and you can find it and try and play with it. If you throw one of the compile switches, it'll then tell you why list of int does not satisfy sortable, and it'll come back and says list of int is not sortable because it doesn't have a subscript operator. That's simple. If you get the extra information, it'll be about four lines as opposed to pages. And that's what I said. So back to something that seems obvious, but certainly is not what has been obvious in the C++ and many other communities for a long time. Generic programming is just programming. People develop strange theories and complicated theories about how you write templates, and you use a different kind of logic when you're writing template programming, and people invent very complicated ways of doing it. But let's look at some code. Here is a square root function like we learned about on the first day of our programming, when we learned programming, right? We can give it something that can be used as a double, like an integer, and everything's fine. And the function gets called, it takes and gives you back the square root of x. And assuming that you know what a square root is, you don't have to look into the implementation, it just gets called. If you give it a square root of something that isn't a double, can't be made into a double, like the address of a double, you get an error message that says square root wants a double. Now let's try that with a container. We take a container, we give it to the container, and it says everything's fine because a vector of string is a container and it's sortable and whatever. It works. Give it something that's not a vector, it says no, sort wants a vector, and the address of a vector is not a vector. So we can get back to a world where the code actually looks very similar, whether it is generic or not. And I don't think we have to learn significantly new concepts. We just have to get back to what we learned about on the first day of our programming course. Writing the templates is a little bit harder, but not much harder, and it's significantly easier than it is today. This lets me into one of my favorite rants, which is that the distinction between these so-called paradigms are more or less a function of the language features people have had available. People have huge discussions about should you do conventional C-style programming, do you use object-oriented programming, putting things in hierarchies, or should you parameterize and use generic programming. I think this is a function of poor language support, and the discussions do harm. So here is the classical example of an object-oriented programming written in a slightly different style. So I am drawing all containers for which the value type is shape, and I do that by calling the for each algorithm for the container using the lambda that draws the shapes. My point here is not, it may not be your ideal draw all, but it's pretty good. I can actually do it slightly better, but this is to make the point. Obviously, this is object-oriented code. I'm doing runtime polymorphism on a class hierarchy of shapes. Is it generic code? Obviously, that container is a parameterized type, and actually draw all is parameterized on the container type and the element type of the container. You go in here, this is perfectly ordinary code. It called a for each algorithm on a container using a lambda. We're certainly borrowing styles from the functional programming world where they have been very useful. So do me a favor, don't get into language wars over paradigms. I think the word paradigm was seriously misdefined by Kuhn when he first came it. He came with it. It was this idea that there is a paradigm, then you get another paradigm, the first one gets totally useless, shouldn't be used anymore, the old guy should die off and the world would be much better for it. He used as an example Newton's world and Einstein's world, but you know, we still live in Newton's world most of the time. And most of the calculations defined by Newton still works. Yes, you need gravitational Einstein logic to deal with the high-precision GPS, but that's very rare. Similarly, Christian Nygaard, who invented object-oriented programming, had the same kind of attitude to paradigm. He used to talk about the old days we had plus and minus, and that was what we had. And then somebody invented multiplication and division. Now, this is a new paradigm, so clearly you have to get rid of the old paradigm. No more plus and minus, that's old-fashioned. And you can write everything you like with multiply and divide. Well, I do wonder how people get negative numbers in that world, but apart from that, I think it's absurd. The old ways sometimes are still simply absorbed in the new stuff, and we can do more and we can do it better. So that's it. So challenges. Basically, I'm not claiming C++ is perfect. We have to see what we can do to make it better. We have to make programmers actually prefer modern code for the kind of applications, the kind of things C++ is good at. So I want the code, like I showed it you, to be used on close to the hardware, high-performance code, because it works, and it works better than the old code. The unique pointer runs exactly as fast. So the last cycle, that well-written code with a raw pointer and proper deletes. The sort algorithm here blows away a CQ sort by factors, not percent. So you can afford it, but we have to convince people to do it. And then we need to make C++ a better language under the constraints that it still has to be the best language for really low-level code and abstraction above that. That's the aim. And that's important. And we have compatibility, performance, portability, range of application areas. We cannot improve the language just by making it a domain-specific language. That again, would violate some of the ground rules. And there's some more information. There's a new website, more or less new website, isocpp.org, that will offer you access to a variety of information, including about the standards and et cetera stuff that floats by. There's some books and a website by me. I'm especially proud of this little book, Tour of C++. It explains all of C++ in 180 pages. Of course, I have to leave out some details. It's at a reasonably high level, but there's lots and lots of code. And so that's a 180-page version. That's what you can read on a long train or plane journey. And the rest is details. Well, there are, 1,300 pages of details in that book. Same number of details, even more details, and 1,300 pages in the standard. And that's encrypted in standard D's to stop you from reading it. I did not invent the rules for the ISO standards, but they can be pretty gross. But if you want to know everything about C++, search for WG21, which is the official name of the Standards Committee. I told you Standard D's encrypts everything, including the name of the Standards Committee. And you can find the standard, you can find every committee document. It's public and available.